This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour's solution to extreme adversity in this economic downturn was, well, rather out of the ordinary. She bought a motorcycle, and what led her to that decision and what happened next might serve as a roadmap for others facing monetary and psychological hardship, and so she's been sharing her story with others, and Tamela Rich shares it with us this hour. I got to tell you, I saw your picture yesterday for the first time, and you are not at all what I thought you would be like. Do you hear this a lot?
Yes. I am not your stereotypical biker.
That's right. You're not. There are no tattoos that I can see.
Yeah.
There are no piercings that I can detect.
Well, I got a couple in my ears.
Earrings. Yeah. And you're not exactly a teenager.
No.
No. This is, when I saw your picture yesterday, I thought, oh my goodness.
She looks like me.
Because I was all set to be intimidated by you.
Oh my gosh.
But I'm not. Well, I may end up being, but at the moment I'm not. Welcome to the program, by the way.
Thank you, Mike.
You reached a period in your life where you'd hit a really rough patch.
I did.
You'd gone from being in the financial world at one of the major banks in mm-hmm. town to buying your own business.
Mm-hmm.
It was an industrial
cleaning business. Mm-hmm.
And you bought it just at the time when all the industry that it cleaned was offshoring all the jobs. Obviously didn't know that when you bought the business.
Well,
did you?
Yeah, I didn't do the best job of due diligence, I suppose, economically. But when plant shutdowns are your growth area of your business, yeah. It's not so good.
So things for you got very dicey financially.
They did.
You owed a lot of money to a lot of different people, some of them friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Most of them friends and family, yeah.
And you had reached a conclusion that unfortunately a lot of people reach in that situation. You were better off, you were more valuable dead than alive.
Mm-hmm. I came out of the insurance business. My family's been in the insurance business, and that was my first career. And I have a lot of life insurance. And so,
does it pay if you take your
yeah.
own life?
Not to give any instructions to anybody
okay,
or not, but if
please,
you've had your policy long enough, it doesn't matter how
okay,
you go.
Right.
And I knew that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had.
But when you're thinking like that, you're not in the right place.
Right.
Okay.
Well, how did you come to? Because looking back, you now have some hindsight.
Yes.
How did you reach the conclusion that maybe you ought to consider it? Suicide, that is.
Well, you're not in a rational place when you're that far gone, when you're that depressed. You're just not in a rational place. And so I was coming at it from a place of honor that I had signed up to pay these people back, you know, and that was my obligation. And, you know, for any listeners who may have friends or family members that they've invested in their business and it's going south, just so you know, the person who owes you the money knows they owe you the money. And every time you call, it's probably not a good idea to just talk about how much money they owe and how quickly they're going to get it paid, et cetera. What that did to me was it just gave me the sense that the money that I need to pay back to these people is more important than anything. Mm. It's more important than my relationship with them. It's more important than the history I have with them. And that's not to say that that's their fault. That's what happened to me mm-hmm. when I just got so far gone and just wasn't thinking properly.
And you've written a couple of articles and many blogs about this very topic,
mm-hmm.
how to handle debt that you can't pay back, how to interact with the people you owe money to,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, which I would think would be very valuable to a lot of people, particularly now.
Particularly now, yes.
Did that take a particular amount of courage to go public with this kind of information, or because you also share a lot about yourself in these articles, did it take courage, or is it something that you feel it just needs to be said?
The latter, particularly in this Great Recession. I mean, if this had happened to me in the go-go 80s, or you know, some other time, you know, it wouldn't be perhaps mm-hmm. as resonant with as many people. But now that so many people find themselves in financial hardship, I felt it was a service, really,
yeah.
to just come out with it.
So before you wrote all these articles and all these blogs on how to deal with financial hardship and how to react to it and what to say to your creditors, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
you sat down and wrote the note.
I did write the note.
The note being, I'm leaving, and here's what I want you to do as a result of my my exit.
Yeah, I was so far gone that there was no sentimentality in the note. The note was simply instructions to my spouse. Okay, you know, I've got this much life insurance, and this is where I want it to go. This is not clear thinking of someone who's in a good mental state. I just want to reiterate
that. What do you think when you sit down to write that note? What are you thinking? I mean, what's going through your head?
Well, it was obligation. You know, I'm obliged to pay these people back, and I'm gonna meet my obligation. I'm gonna do whatever it takes to meet this obligation. That was what was in my mind.
So no sentimentality,
no
remorse, no woe is me.
Nope.
Just very calculated financial fiduciary responsibilities being taken care of in this note. And then you finish the note. And you go look for the means.
Right.
And your medicine cabinet betrayed you.
I am such a clean living person. I don't smoke. I don't drink. And our medicine cabinet is just, you know, like analgesics and
death by laxative doesn't work. Is that what it is?
I'm told that's not effective. Yeah. No. I mean, we can laugh about it now, but honestly, Mike, I had the physician's desk reference pulled up online, and I was just going through, you know, old medicines from tooth extractions and, you know, everything that's in the medicine cabinet that you're supposed to throw away when it expires and you don't. And I was just looking up everything to see, was there a bad enough combination?
And there wasn't, fortunately for you. And that, I'm told, took you out of this trance that you say you were in.
I was in a trance, yes.
As you wrote this note and prepared for it.
You
are the classic story of... Don't do it because there is a brighter, the sun will come out tomorrow. I'm sorry to be so corny.
Yes, Annie.
That's right. But there's a brighter day ahead, or it will get better, to quote another suicide prevention thing. It does get better?
It does get better if you take the steps you need to take. And that's the other thing I want to say is, you know, if I had been a heart attack victim coming on here, there would be no stigma. I wouldn't have gotten phone calls last night from people who know me well saying, ooh, are you sure you really want to, right, tell your story? You know, mental illness is an illness just like, you know, a heart condition. And there's no stigma coming on and talking about eating right and taking the right meds and exercising and all that kind of stuff. Let's bring mental illness out of the closet and have a good airing.
So you can't, but does it give you pause to realize how close you came? Had the means been there, you would have acted on it, correct?
I was there.
So does it give you pause to realize how close, how lucky you were that you didn't have the means, or how close you came? I mean, what do you think about that moment in time?
Well, I don't think about it. I don't dwell on it. You know, there's a prayer that really got me through. It's if you don't mind, I'll just say it.
No, go right ahead.
Oh God, refresh and gladden my spirit. Purify my heart, illumine my powers. I lay all my affairs in thy hands. Thou art my guide and my refuge. I will no longer be sorrowful and grieved. I will be a happy and joyful being. I will no longer be troubled by the anxieties of life. I lay all my affairs in thy hands.
Where does that come from?
I'm a Baha'i. That's a Baha'i prayer.
Is this the prayer that I read that you wrote when you were on the phone with creditors trying to not reason with them, but just talk to them?
Yep.
And they would be assaulting you with,
yes.
You know, you owe me this money.
Yes.
You had a pad of paper in front of you.
Yes, I did. And you wrote
a prayer. Was that the prayer?
That's the prayer. I wrote it when I was in court. I've been to court. And I just would write it again and again and again and again. And it just brought me to a place where I could realize, you know, always do your best. Always do your best. In any situation, always do your best. And, that helped me just stay in the present and do the best I could at the moment.
There are a lot of people in this situation. For you, it turned out evidently okay. And we'll talk about what you did as a result of this and the things that remarkable things that you have done in the aftermath of all this. But it didn't have to be that way. I mean, sure, it did turn out better for you. But in that day, the next day after, the next 3 hours after, how did you know that you shouldn't go out and find something to do it with, drive off a bridge? How did you know that you made the right decision?
Well, actually, that night, you know, family life kicked in, and there was dinner and things to do, and so I, you know, was busy leading my life. But a friend, a really good friend of mine, a Baha'i friend of mine, reached out. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, fortunately, you know, serendipity, whatever you may want to call it, just reached out, knew I was in a tough place, and just reached out. And she was the person that I told what I had been through.
Right.
And she was great because she didn't get hysterical and, you know, try to like talk me out of it and all that kind of stuff. She took the absolute right approach. For me, it was the right approach. She just walked me through, you know,
asked questions.
Yes. She just said, well, what would happen here? And what do you think would happen after? And what do you? So she let me do the talking. And I talked myself through, oh, why this is a really bad idea.
But you still owed the money. You still had creditors.
Uh-huh.
I believe you still went to court in the aftermath of
Did
you have any second thoughts? Did you take a moment to think, well, okay, well, maybe I should go ahead and do this. Was that the first time you ever considered it? And was it the last time you ever considered it?
I have depression in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And, what I didn't realize is that there's this thing called suicidal ideation. And I've been having it for years, not just in the wake of this. When something would go wrong, there's like this little fantasy that goes on in your mind that says, well, if I took a hard left in traffic right now, all this would go away. And you're not going to do it, but it's just like this fleeting little, it's what they call suicidal ideation. It just flits through your mind and you're not taking any action on it, but it's just a whisper. It's just a whisper that says there is this other option.
Hmm.
And so that's one of, now that I know what I know, that's one of, if you have suicidal ideation, you need to get professional help immediately. That's not normal. It's just not healthy that you would start thinking in that way. And well, I'd had that for years. And, you know, because we don't talk about mental illness in this culture.
Right.
We don't know. It, you know, if your left arm starts tingling, there's a chance that you got a heart problem, right?
Mm, right.
Nobody talks about you might need to go see a mental health professional if, and that's what I want to talk about. So, yeah, I was having these little episodes, and I wouldn't do anything about it, but they would just dance through my mind.
Mm.
What was the root question? Sorry, Mike.
Was that the first time? So obviously it wasn't. Was it the last time that you thought about it?
It was the last time I thought that seriously about it. No, I didn't have any second thoughts. I mean, after I talked to my friend, and she really helped get me grounded spiritually and so on. You know, those thoughts, you can't stop those thoughts coming through your mind, but you can deal with them.
And somehow, we'll talk about this as the program goes on. You go from that thought,
mm-hmm.
that suicidal thought, and you come out of the trance. You think, whoa, 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 what am I doing here? This is all wrong. Your friend then discusses things with you and sets mm-hmm. your mind on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow you get to this idea of riding a motorcycle
yeah.
across the country.
Yes.
What has the one thing got to do with the other? And I have about 10 seconds here.
A motorcyclist best understands why a dog hangs its face out the window when it's going down the road.
All right. We'll leave it there and go to the break and come back and have you explain that as my tongue hangs out like a dog. Our guest is Tamela Rich, a cross-country motorcyclist who did this for a lot of different reasons, which we'll go into here in the next few minutes. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CPCC's Corporate and Continuing Education, offering a Project Management Plus Certificate program in November to help professionals take the lead in their careers. Details at 704-330-4223. And Trader Joe's, a neighborhood grocery store, offering dinner choices including marinated meats, heat and eat sides, and stir fries with flavors inspired from around the globe. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. Well, if you're of a certain age, you will remember Lily Tomlin from her days on Roland and Martin's Laugh-In. If you're not, maybe you know her more from her work on The West Wing or perhaps Damages with Glenn Close. Well, she remains both a serious actress and a very funny lady, and she's bringing her comedic talents to town this weekend. But before she arrives, she spends the hour with us. Lily Tomlin joins us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, attorneys general from all 50 states are investigating mortgage foreclosures. Some lawmakers are calling for a national moratorium. Consumer groups want solutions to keep families in their homes.
That's the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Tamela Rich, who has a unique story. Came back from the brink in a very dire financial situation. And we've been talking about that. And now we're going to talk about what she did as a result of coming out of this and getting back into her right mind, although some people would question.
Why. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because you decided that the solution, one of the solutions to this, which you did, you wanted to change your life.
Yes.
You wanted adventure in your life, and you decided you're going to get it by riding a motorcycle across the country.
Mm-hmm.
You owed people money. Some of them were your friends, and here you are setting off. You could have gone to work. But here you are setting off across the country on a motorcycle.
Well, there's a period of time between those two.
I'm sure there is. But so, you had never ridden a motorcycle.
Never. I'd ridden on the back. I didn't own one.
You didn't own one. Right. And you didn't get the motorcycle that you rode across country on until when?
The night before I left.
Is that wise?
Well, I had trained on that bike. I had trained on that bike. So here's the story. The depths of my despair were about 4 years ago. And, obviously I needed to make money and, you know, dig out as best I could, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we're in the pits of the thing that shall not be called a depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go back in corporate America. You know, So I've got nothing but my wits, my experience, and a computer. I've always been a writer. I've always been a good writer. And I decided, I'll hang out my shingle as a business writer. So I had to decide how to market myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any money to market myself. I come from a financial services background. So I decided, let me get on this Twitter thing and see, you know, who I can connect with.
You have to be a short writer on Twitter.
You do, 140. But what happened is there's this great community online of people who are traders and financial professionals. They're, because the markets are always so influenced by news, etc. I got into this Twitter stream on a site called StockTwits,
mm-hmm.
and met terrific people. And, you know, got to promote myself, you know, in conversations with them, as a business writer and started picking up clients. And then I got a call from Matt Davio in Oregon, who's a trader. And he said, "You are such a good writer." He said, "We need to do a project together." And that's where the book was born.
The book is something that you set off to write called Trade-Offs, Leveraging the Longs and Shorts of Life. And Matt Davio is your co-author.
Yes.
In this book. Now, he lives in Oregon.
Yes.
That's why you set off across the country?
Ostensibly, that's why. I didn't realize until the day I was coming home mm-hmm. from my trip, I didn't realize until then that there was a deeper reason that I had decided to do this. So ostensibly, yes, the reason was I was going to, you know, when you're a writer, unless you're Grisham or someone telling a political tell-all, you're not going to get any support from the publishers. You've got to sell your own books. You've got to develop an author's platform.
Mm-hmm.
So ostensibly, this trip was a way to build the author's platform. I also needed to get face-to-face with my co-author and, you know, start writing the book.
But why? Is there Skype?
There is.
There are telephones.
And we've done a fair amount of that,
okay.
Actually. We just really wanted to get, you know, he had some books that I wanted to be able to, you know, read mm-hmm, and research mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know. So, but it was when I was coming home on the last day from, what's that thing called? The Bantam Chef in Chesney.
You got me.
It's this incredible dive down there. We had stopped, my co-writers and I had stopped there and on the way home, it occurred to me that deep down, I wanted to have something that I could say, aha, I succeeded. I'd had a lot of failure in my life, and I had allowed myself to define myself by that failure and trying to come back from that failure. And, maybe most people in my life didn't look at me as I had thought they were looking at me as, oh yeah, she, this didn't work out so well. But it was important for me to say, I did this, I succeeded, I'm back.
but you set off on this motorcycle cross-country thing, having never owned or ridden a motorcycle.
I didn't set off not having ridden. So what happened is I was talking to my co-author in January, and we were talking about needing to get together and how we were going to get this book written, et cetera. And at a certain point, my spirit bypassed my head, and I said to him, Matt, you know what I'd really like to do is I'd really like to just get on a motorcycle and drive from here to Oregon. And he said, then you should. And he was my first sponsor. He PayPal'd me enough money to take my MSF safety class at CPCC. He PayPal'd me enough to do it. And so then, that was the first step.
Now, I'm only going to mention this because you mentioned it.
What is that?
That you are in your mid to late 40s.
Yes.
And you were, 46, 47, 48, something like that?
I'm 48 now.
Okay. So you were 46, I guess, when you set off. Is that right? Am I right?
No, I just did it this summer.
Okay, so you're 48.
Yeah.
What was the reaction of your family?
Well, initially, first when I said I wanted to do this, I said, I told them around the dinner table, and everybody was like, okay, whatever. Cause they knew that I hadn't ridden a motorcycle before. We didn't have the money for me to buy a motorcycle. So it was sort of like me just having a fluke whatever. And so then, the PayPal from my co-author was the first in a series of dominoes that just started falling in my favor. And so as things started catching up, BMW sponsored me. BMW trained me after I got my first licensing class. BMW, the Performance Center in Greenville.
Why?
Because they knew I was riding a bike. Women are the largest, growing sector of new motorcyclists. And BMW's market in particular, the bikes are expensive as the cars are. And they needed someone who, I was going to write a book. I was going to blog about do social media about my trip across the way. And, the people that I interface with are attorneys, accountants, and financial advisors. Those are the folks who have the money to buy BMW bikes.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we want to show, this is the Performance Center in South Carolina. They offer not only car training, you can learn how to drive like James Bond if you want to down there, but they also offer motorcycle training. Little factoid, BMW made motorcycles before it made cars.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, down at the Performance Center, they offer motorcycle training. And so what a feather in their cap if they could take this pudgy 48-year-old woman who'd never ridden a bike before, train her how to ride it, send her across country, and she comes back unscathed. What a success story. So Dan Gubitosa, great manager down there, took an entrepreneurial risk on me, and it's paying off.
In the early stages of learning to ride this, because I've never ridden one, and the idea of riding one, that does intimidate me.
Does it?
Did you have any second thoughts? Like, this would be easier if they just gave me a BMW, like a 6 series, a 5 series. I could do this trip. That's right. I could do this trip really much easier. Did you ever have a thought like, maybe I shouldn't do this? Maybe
no.
I should just ride, get
well,
out of the car.
There were some nervous times. I mean, a lot of people who love me very much wanted to talk me out of this. My brother and my dad, the way I got the idea really was my brother and dad last summer wanted to do some father-son bonding. And so they decided, let's do something neither of us know how to do. Let's learn to ride motorcycles. So they got BMWs and rode all the great parks out west, the Tetons and Yellowstone and Rushmore, and they did all that. And so that's where the seed of this motorcycle thing was planted, because they'd send iPhone movies, from the geysers and all this kind of stuff. And I always thought, well, I'd like to do that. But Riding a motorcycle reminds me of riding a horse. I have really good balance. I'm fortunate that I rode horses. I rode hunter jumpers when I was a kid. And I also know how to shift. My first car was a 73 Super Beetle, so I had to shift. So those are two big things. Balance and knowing how to shift are two big things, for riding a motorcycle. So, I loved it. When I got on, it felt like riding a horse. It was intimidating. I wasn't good at it initially, but I have good balance, and that's a help.
And you left here in March, is that right?
No, I left on June 26th.
June, okay.
I was gone 43 days.
So, did you plan it out?
I did. I used social media extensively.
So you knew where you were where you were going to stop each day and where you were going, the route you were going to take. It wasn't haphazard.
It was well defined. What happened is I'm a member of the Charlotte Social Media Club, and they've been great. They have social media breakfasts, and they sponsored me with enough to live on for 2 days on the road, and really taught me how to use all the social media out there.
What do you need to know? Because it seems to me taking a motor. Did you do this by yourself?
Mostly by myself.
In other words, you didn't set out with a companion. You picked up people along the way and met people along the way.
But I did.
So when you set out by yourself on a motorcycle for the first time in your life,
yes,
at 48,
yes,
what do you need to know?
You need really good training. I mean, I was very fortunate to have excellent training. I took 2 days of one-on-one instruction at the Performance Center. I took a class from a highway patrol officer in the Raleigh area. My brother let me ride his bike. I had really good training. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't recommend anyone do this without great training.
Well, it's one thing to learn how to ride the bike. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to learn how to deal with
The road. And that's where,
life on the road.
That's where Facebook came in.
Okay.
That's where, and my local friends who I met on Twitter and through social media who were bikers, that's where they really came in. A friend of mine, Anthony Proctor, more than once had several serious words of prayer with me about, Tamla, I'm not sure you need to be doing this. He's a motorcyclist. Mm-hmm. And accompanied me on the first day along with Nathan Ritchie and his father and brother and a friend of mine, Kay Henderson. But, you know, more than once, experienced motorcyclists, you know, calmed me down and said, you really need to know this is a serious thing. You need to know what you're taking on.
What were they worried about?
That I didn't know
other
what
bikers,
I didn't know.
Other bikers, the culture, people who look at bikers differently than they would if you stepped out of an automobile, the kind of people that
skills.
Might gravitate toward you.
No, it wasn't the people that they were worried about
okay.
for me.
It was my skills.
It was my skills. When you're riding a motorcycle, you know, when I'm in the car, I'm multitasking. My mind isn't on it. I'm going to be honest. You know, driving a car is really boring. And unfortunately for motorcyclists, most of the people that are on the road with you are really bored out of their mind driving cars, and you've got to be a defensive driver.
Well, you said that car drivers aren't used to looking for motorcyclists, so a motorcyclist always has to be running through what-if scenarios and planning for the worst. That's appealing to you?
You know, it helps me, Mike. You know, I have the kind of mind that, you know, goes off on, you know, I'm always thinking about things. And so for me, riding a motorcycle just keeps me absolutely in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a refreshing change from where I usually spend my time, which is up in my head and in the future and, you know, writing things and whatever. So riding a bike, it's really a grounding experience. So the people who were concerned about me were concerned about my skills and my safety. Now, my husband was concerned about some of the things that you said. You know, he wanted me to make sure that I had mace with me. And, you know, he was really concerned that, you know, that people would see me as an easy mark, if you will. But what I did is I went on Facebook and I found this group of motorcyclists, women motorcyclists, middle-aged women motorcyclists, who were raising money for breast cancer.
In truth, they were people who portrayed themselves as middle-aged female motorcyclists. How did you know that's who they were? This is Facebook. This is social media. You don't know that people are telling you the truth.
Well, it was a group of, it was a long-standing group of folks.
Okay.
And, you know, and on Facebook, as you know, people upload videos and pictures of themselves. So, you know, you can pretty readily see that, you know, this isn't a scam. That these are, and they had done this ride 2 years before as well. And so I and I actually spoke with one of the organizers on the phone several times, just to get a feel for the group, et cetera. And so this group that I hooked up with, is a group of Canadian and American motorcyclists from all parts.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Is this the Conga group?
This is the Conga group.
Okay. And it's called the Conga group because?
Because wherever you start, you're forming a conga line that goes to the meetup place in Wyoming.
Okay.
So I had people join me. When I started out, I had my local Charlotte friends ride out with me, including Jason Drake, who's the district manager for Caribou Coffee, which was a sponsor of mine. Okay. He's a motorcyclist.
Mm-hmm.
So they rode out with me the first day. And then the second day, I had a cousin in Kentucky who had friends. She doesn't ride, but she had friends who did. So they had a fundraising lunch, and they rode me up to Cincinnati. So that was another group. I hadn't met them, but, you know, friends of friends, one of those things. And I have to say, I met her. I re-met her through Facebook. We had lost touch years ago, and she found me on Facebook and, you know, helped me put that together. So, so just meeting people through social media enabled me to I traveled with people that, yeah, I was meeting for the first time.
So they accompanied you, they funded you, they helped you, they gave you tips?
They did. They would buy my lunch or uh-huh. fill up my tank. Or
was this every day and everything?
No, it was not. I was about 70% by myself.
Wow.
But it was front loaded. My accompaniment was front loaded on the front part of the trip. So that it was coming back that I was more by myself. And that worked great. Because by the time I got out to Oregon, I was a more confident and competent rider.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back mostly by myself was not a problem.
And you rode here today?
I did.
On your cycle. You've kept this up. This is not something you dropped as soon as the trip was over.
No. This is my main means of transportation.
Okay.
and I'm going to do this trip again next year, and I intend to be a much more accomplished biker.
What is it like? Everybody knows what it's like to drive in a car on a long trip. What is it like to have to ride a motorcycle on a long trip in all kinds of weather, all kinds of temperatures, by yourself in traffic?
Well, out west I wasn't in traffic so much.
Mm-hmm.
Cincinnati,
though.
I did, and Chicago,
uh-huh.
St. Louis. These are the bigger cities that I was in.
Right.
But the key is in the way that you phrase the question. What is it to have to drive a motorcycle? You don't feel like that when you're on a motorcycle.
Okay.
I feel like that when I'm in a car.
It's
oh,
free.
God, I have to drive. Yes, it's what I love. Several things I love about it. We've talked about the Zen part, just being in the moment. But I love, interestingly, I love smelling the smells. You know, when you're a kid and you're riding a bike and you'd come off of a big hill and then you'd go down into the bottom of the hill and mm-hmm. there might have been a stream or something and you'd get that whiff of mm-hmm. green, humid air,
right?
When you're going through a city and you smell the brownie factory, just being a part of God's creation on a bike is exhilarating.
You're not in your cocoon. Tamela Rich is our guest. We will continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Ivy, hosting a silent auction in support of the Alzheimer's Association tomorrow at 6 p.m. in South Park. Food, wine, and auction items, including fashion, art, meals, and more. Details, theivey.com. And the Charlotte Chamber, presenting My Chamber app, a mobile directory of businesses owned by local chamber members, compatible with all phone platforms. Public download available at mychamberapp.com or charlottechamber.com. Attorneys general from all 50 states are investigating mortgage foreclosures, how a proposed moratorium on mortgage foreclosures could affect homeowners, banks, and the economy, the topic at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, do it now, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or every other way imaginable, charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
See Actors Theater of Charlotte's final rehearsal of the comedy Becky's New Car with WFAE. It's the story of a woman in a midlife crisis that quickly accelerates out of control. We're going behind the scenes on Tuesday evening, October 26th at 7:30. Information and reservations are available at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking to Tamela Rich, a local woman who suffered a midlife crisis and took matters into her own hands, got a bicycle, not a bicycle, a motorcycle, and rode across country. First, to meet a co-author of a book that she is in process of writing, Trade-Offs, Leveraging the Longs and Shorts of Life. And it branched out into other things, and we've been talking about how social media played a role in all of this. You are also, like so many other people, a boomer,
mm-hmm.
and a pre-Title IX boomer.
Yes.
You're somebody who did not really participate in a lot of athletic activities, particularly team activities, because there weren't that
there
many
weren't any.
For
when
girls.
When I was a kid, when I was in high school, if it was fall, I could run cross country or play volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
Winter, I could play basketball. And spring, I could run track and field.
That was it.
That was it.
Before Title IX came in and said, you've got to give girls the opportunities that you give boys. Is this your opportunity? Are you telling other women that just because you've not been physical, you still can be?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
How physical is it?
It's actually quite physical. For me, the kind of bike I ride and the style of riding that I do is more physical than maybe if someone wanted to ride a different kind of bike and, you know, just sort of cruise through
you
town.
You take charge. I can tell.
Well, my bike is a BMW 650 GS, which means GS is German for street and dirt.
Okay.
And so I can take my bike off road. But I can also ride it on the street. So it's a dual sport bike.
Mm-hmm.
And I like being able to go off. When I was in Mount Rushmore, I took an ATV trail. I camped out. I was at the KOA there in Mount Rushmore. And, they rented ATVs there. And so I just took my bike on an ATV trail and, you know, went through some mud and did some stuff like that. So I enjoy that.
Where do you stay when you ride a bike across country? Just motels or campgrounds?
I did stay in hotels this year. Mm-hmm. I did catch up with some of the Conga riders, the Oregon riders in particular. They just took me in and, you know, we rode for days and mm-hmm. they live in Oregon, not Oregon, I'm Idaho. And, you know, I stayed at their homes and they were great, but mostly I stayed in hotels. I did go to one of those KOA cabins, the little cabins that mm-hmm. they have at KOAs. I was there with two other women that were riding with me. They rode with me from Wisconsin to Mount Rushmore, mm-hmm. and we all stayed in the campground in there. But next year when I go, I'm going to do some tent camping.
You are an adventurous person. Were you before this trip?
I've never been so much a physically adventurous person. That's been unleashed, I think.
Okay.
I think. Obviously I took an entrepreneurial risk and, you know, so there's that element
right.
of adventure. But I rode horses. I rode hunter jumpers and mm-hmm. enjoyed that. I mean, I like being outdoors. I do like being outdoors.
So you want other women to know that it's not too late to discover what you're capable of doing physically.
That's right. You know, I think, you know, for me, you know, I'm a head person. I mean, I've always been a head person.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really great to balance, the mind, the body and the spirit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and motorcycling helps me do that.
This book that you're writing, Trade-Offs, Leveraging the Longs and Shorts of Life. This is about, as I understand it, examining how financial traders
mm-hmm.
deal with balancing risk and reward and how that can be applied to ordinary people in their day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm.
What have you discovered?
Hmm. I've discovered that people, a lot of times real life decisions happen from the gut and not so much, it's not so balanced by the head. So for example, one of the things that we're going to talk about in the book is end of life decisions. talk to palliative care physicians and so forth. And people, because people don't, in this, nobody thinks they're going to die, evidently, and they don't do the planning. They don't talk about, you know, their wishes, et cetera, mm-hmm. with their families. And so families get into this position where, you know, they're in the hospital. They're trying to figure out what would mom want me to do, that kind of a thing. And so this book can help people make decisions that balance head and heart. You know, I'm going to talk to a friend of mine. I'm going to interview for the book, who had a serious motorcycle crash actually several years ago, and has had upwards of 50 operations. And he has, and you know that, and his crash was about 10 years ago, and he has some real thoughts about now, with the benefit of hindsight, what decisions would he have made differently, knowing there's a trade-off of quality of life and quantity of life, and that's one
really?
Of the things we're going to get into in the book.
So is this motorcycle trip, that to me, that would be the trade-off. You're exponentially increasing the excitement of your life, the mm-hmm. adventure quotient of your life, mm-hmm. by taking a trip like this, mm-hmm. but you are putting yourself at more risk, perhaps, than you mm-hmm. would have if you got on an airplane. Maybe mm-hmm. not.
Maybe
I don't know.
Not. Yeah. But you look at the statistics.
But it feels that way.
Uh-huh.
So is that what you're saying, that you ought to amp up the excitement, the danger, the adventure? Go ahead and live, mm. even if it's...
No, a financial trader would tell you that they're going to hedge. They're going to insure their trades. And so I insured my trade by getting really good training before I left. I wasn't a nutso that just jumped on a bike, right?
And you're not recommending that.
I am not recommending that.
Okay.
I hedged. I insured my risk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this book is about. This is about, okay, you want to do this. Okay, how do you protect your downside? How do you, right? So that's what this book's about. So if you want to live a higher quality of life and maybe a shorter quantity of life, well, you know, be cognizant that that's what you're doing.
Well, does it have to be, if you have a better quality of life, does it have to be shorter?
No, it doesn't. But what I was referring to when I was talking about quality versus quantity really had to do with more end-of-life decisions.
Okay.
And, you know, the 80-year-old who, you know, dies on the table getting hip replacement because they've got a heart condition, and you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
That's really where I was going with quantity versus quality.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a phone call from Steve, who has been waiting for a little while here in Davidson. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thank you very much for taking my call. It's an unusual situation for me to be able to listen to the program today. I've been a licensed motorcycle operator for 40 years, and I agree so much with your guest's comments about the idea of riding being almost a spiritual experience, and to do it, in my opinion, safely and correctly, of being forced into the moment, being in that moment so completely, understanding where you need to be in terms of in a particular lane, what the traffic situations are around you, all those things come into play. And, you know, I would suggest that, you know, the most recent comments that you all discussed about this trade-off of quantity and quality, this is an ongoing debate I have in my own head, and never mind with family and friends about riding motorcycles. There is just something to that, you know, we have to live life. My best childhood friend died of a heart attack last year. He and I rode motorcycles as teenagers, and we were out of touch. But, you know, I think that's just the nature of life, is that we all do have an end of life, and it's trying for me to hit that sweet spot of quantity and quality, and some amount of motorcycling comes into that. Now, I don't ride motorcycles now as a primary form of transportation. I don't leave for a motorcycle ride in bad weather. I'm confident of riding in bad weather, but that's a trade-off that I don't do anymore at this point in my riding career. But I agree so much with the comments made about what motorcycling, what that experience is, the smells, the cut grass, that kind of thing. And I'd leave with one, share one more comment with you, and take your comments off the air. I appreciate the language that the author is using here and the concern that her friends had about encountering people on the road. There are a lot more what I refer to as motorcyclists or motorcycle enthusiasts out there. We keep an eye out for one another. See someone on the side of the road, you know, we tend to pull over and make sure they're okay. There is a, a loose affiliation or a camaraderie among motorcyclists that we know what we've chosen to do and understand the, you know, the nature of riding on interstates and that kind of thing. So we do keep an eye on one another, and there are a lot more of us who are not outlaw motorcyclists but are motorcycle enthusiasts than vice versa. So thanks again for taking my call.
Thank you for your call, Steve. You were doing a lot of nodding in agreement during that call.
You know, when I was on the road, I never met a scary person. Never met a scary person. Never met, and didn't have any encounters with scary animals. And I was fortunate. The weather wasn't scary.
Well, we live in a culture driven by fear.
That is the truth. And what he was talking about, you know, you've got to be in the right mind when you set out. There are times when you shouldn't get on your bike. If you can't focus.
Because it does take great focus,
it
doesn't it?
It does.
Being in the moment is you got to really be concentrating all the time. It's not like driving a car, perhaps, where the thing almost drives itself.
Right.
You can't. It will not drive. It will fall over. It's not going to drive itself, right?
No, it's not going to drive itself. What I wanted to say about one of the lessons that I learned from being on the road on a motorcycle, it's sort of like, remember Hurricane Hugo? Mm-hmm. When no matter who you were, what was going on, if you saw a human being in need, you came to their rescue.
Right.
There's something I think about human beings that when they see someone else in a vulnerable place, that brings out the angels, the inner angels in all of us. And I think that what he said about this loose affiliation of motorcycle
enthusiasts.
Kind of a
fraternity or sorority, in your case.
In my case. Matter of fact, I mean, there are people who looked very scary, like, you know, looked like a stereotypical, oh my gosh, kind of a person, who were just angels.
Yeah.
You know, let me help you with that, dear.
So,
nothing.
Don't
to
judge
it.
A book by its cover.
Exactly.
He also used a word that I think you probably like, because if I read one of your articles correctly, you bemoan the fact that there, and I think it's you who bemoans this fact, that there's not an appropriate word to distinguish a person who drives the bike versus one who rides on the on the seat behind the rider. And he used the word operator.
Operator,
he's
yes.
been a motorcycle operator.
Yes. There's this idea that, you know, that you're just sort of passively, you know, riding the bike. And that's not the truth. It requires operational skill. And the highway patrol officer that I took training from, you know, he wouldn't let us say, I'm going to go ride my bike.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you're driving it, right? You're in charge. You're driving your bike. I like that.
Along the way, you did do some recreational things. You checked out Evel Knievel's jump ramp over the Snake River in Idaho. Any temptation to try it out for yourself?
Zero.
Okay. What other sites did you see?
I saw the Mitchell Corn Palace.
What is that?
It is this cool place that what they do is they take all the corn products and they make mosaics on the outside of the building. So the husks, the corn themselves, you know,
the kernels.
Yes,
the cobs.
They make the mosaics It's like 100 and some years old now, but now the ethanol people have taken it over. It's like a major.
So now it's liquid.
Propaganda.
So what?
Site for them.
Where is this? Iowa?
It's in Mitchell, South Dakota.
Okay.
It's lovely. It's lovely what the mosaics that they've built on this.
You
building.
You also visited a museum commemorating all the people, all the men who ran for president and lost.
And lost. In Norton, Kansas. Yes.
Why is
it was
there?
Outstanding. Kansas, now I wrote a blog post about this. I just published yesterday. Kansas takes a lot of heat for being boring and flat and, you know, just a place you pass through to get someplace else. But they've done a really good job of capitalizing on history there. And I rode the Route 36 was at one time the Pony Express, the Oregon Trail, and the California Trail.
Wow.
There's a lot of history there.
Yeah, and you also went through the geographic center of the lower 48 states, which is also in Kansas.
In Lebanon, Texas. Kansas, that's
right. And the Wyoming Frontier Prison Museum.
Yes.
You went because you thought it would be fun.
You know, I did. I used this this site called Roadside America, and you can look up kitsch and Americana in any town, city, state across the country, and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. A frontier prison museum. How did they, you know, hold Butch Cassidy? And actually, Butch Cassidy had been imprisoned at the place that I went to. But
was it fun?
It was. You know, I think I sort of fell into this this hero worship of criminals and outlaws when I thought this would be fun. I mean, you know, Mother Teresa, you know, is just one of many people who've lived a life of service, and most of them go uncelebrated. But yet, I can't tell you the number of places that I could have gone and seen where Jesse James did this or Sundance did that or whatever. And I don't know. It made me think.
About
it made me think.
15 seconds.
Yes.
Any words of wisdom for people who have been listening to this conversation thinking, I need to change my life the way she changed hers?
Take the first step. If the first step is just telling someone, take it. You may be surprised, just like I was, how things just fall into place and miracles happen, and you can change your life too.
Tamela Rich, cross-country motorcyclist, did it for breast cancer research, also did it to write a book, which you can be looking for, on called Trade-Offs, Leveraging the Longs and Shorts of Life. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.